Good morning. In the immortal words of Frank Sinatra, I'll ask how everyone got into my room. So this morning, you know, one of the things that we've debated often, and I've heard it even this morning, is you know, that especially with the Orioles winning some games these days, which is great to see, you ask, well, what is the Oriole way, right? We all kind of know it. It's had thousands of explanations, and I'm going to take some time this morning to give you a different interpretation and sort of explain why I think that the forgotten man in the whole process is this guy right here, Harry Dalton. So what about Harry Dalton? In 1966, Sam Lacy, who wrote for the Baltimore Afro-American, posited a theory that as the Orioles were running to their first pennant, that there was someone that was overlooked when people were debating the team and who was the most influential member, if it was Frank Robinson or Brooks Robinson or one of the pitchers. It was, he goes, what about this guy, Harry Dalton? And the name of the article was Harry Who? And I feel like that has perpetuated itself. Harry died in 2005. And Harry died in 2005, and that sort of clouded his legacy because the people that worked for him and the people that employed him outlived him. So many people have looked for a father of the success of the Orioles and the father of the Oriole way. They say, well, it's Earl Weaver. You know, Earl was the linchpin, or it was the great players, or it was the coaching staff. And what we tend to overlook is that this guy hired a lot of those people, and he worked with them on a daily basis. Harry Dalton was like the third employee that the Orioles ever hired. So we're going to look at how he shaped the Oriole way and led to them being one of the best teams in baseball history. So he said, present at the creation for $45 a week. He got a job out of the Air Force for $45 a week. He originally wanted to work in the PR department. The PR director, who will be talked about by another Sabre member today, I noticed, sent him to Jim McLaughlin, who was the farm director at the time, and Jim McLaughlin hired him. Harry was a son of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. He had gone to Amherst College. He was a Korean War vet. He did 3 years in Korea as a PR person for the Air Force. He was awarded a Bronze Star for his time there. And to make ends meet, even as he's working for the Orioles, they didn't even have offices at the stadium, so they were driving from downtown Baltimore to the stadium, and then they were, at night, Harry would go out on York Road and drive cab to make ends meet, because he was also helping to support his parents. So he's the assistant to Jim McLaughlin, the farm director, and in the early days, this picture here is actually really neat. It's from the Thomasville History Center, the Thomasville paper ran this. Thomasville was sort of the incubator for a lot of the Orioles' success early on. That is the first day of the first spring training of the Orioles. That picture was in the paper. And Harry's job was to kind of take care of all the administrative paperwork and things. So he becomes indispensable to Jim McLaughlin. Jim McLaughlin says, well, I don't like to go on the road, and I don't like to give interviews, and I don't like to do all this. So he says, you know, you ask me about these players, go talk to that Dalton kid. He knows everybody. I mean, he knows the chart up and down. So he gets known in the organization as a hustler, a guy that will just do whatever needs to get done to help things along. And, you know, there was a big battle internally between Jim McLaughlin and Paul Richards over sort of the heart and mind and control of the team. Richards was the GM. McLaughlin wanted to build from inside. Richards wanted to spend money like Joe Hamper, who was actually Harry Dalton's best man at his wedding and the CFO of the Orioles at the end of his career, said, we gave, you know, they used to joke that they gave Paul Richards an unlimited budget, and he went over that. And he spent a lot of money on Bonus Baby. So Harry was one of the people that helps McLaughlin create this sense of homegrown by 1960. You know, our team will be stocked by our farm system by 1960, and they came close, and it really became one of the linchpins of how Harry Dalton would do business for the next 40 plus years. So McLaughlin sort of burns out his welcome with the Orioles. First they get rid of Paul Richards, first they get rid of McLaughlin, then eventually Paul Richards would leave to go to Houston. And so Harry Dalton becomes the last man standing, and he works well with the new GM, Lee McPhail. And he becomes the farm director, helps build a winning system. He's an information junkie. He wants opinions. He wants all the information in the world. He really, as rudimentary as it was a firm believer in the early stages of analytics and using splits and platooning, the things that Casey Stengel had made famous, and later on Earl Weaver was a big believer in. So he also becomes a really great evaluator of talent, because he's around a group of scouts that sort of take him under their wing and teach them, guys like Walter Yauss, and he really starts to understand the game of baseball at a very deep level. So in 1965, he's named the replacement for Lee McPhail, and the last thing Lee McPhail did was hand Harry Dalton a piece of paper and says, here, I just made this trade for you for an outfielder, maybe you've heard of him, Frank Robinson. And Harry tells the story famously that the deal almost didn't go through because he felt that if all he got back was one player, people would sit there and complain over their cornflakes. So he tried to get a pitcher from the Reds, and that almost derailed the whole deal. And Lee McPhail looked at him and said, all right, quit messing around, call him, and get it done. So Harry never takes credit for that trade. You know, people are like, oh, he made the Frank Robinson trade. Harry never took credit for it. He said, Lee did all the work. I just, you know, ushered it all in. So he creates what they is called, came to be known as the Dalton Gang. And it's a group of scouts and advisors, and includes at various points Frankie Lane, Ray Poinevent, Walter Yauss, Walter Shannon, guys that have been around the game for a long time. And that meetings in there are sort of collegial and corporate and a dash of barroom. They used to actually, in Milwaukee, there's one famous incident where Ray Scarborough, who was a scout, and Ray Poinevent, another scout, almost came to blows in a meeting over debating on whether they should trade someone, and Harry loved it. So he lets others put in a system of this sort of informal, hey, we're going to teach guys, but we're going to teach it our way, and it's, you know, Billy Hunter, he said, taught running, and George Bamberger was pitching, and it wasn't written down. It was just kind of there, and he lets others take the credit for that. He never looks outwardly for credit. That so if people said, well, it's this, you know, this is why they're winning, and he's okay with that. Harry's okay with that. So they win the World Series in 66, in four straight. In 67 and 68, things do not go as well as everyone had kind of hoped. And, you know, he's a firm believer in science and chemistry, and he believes that, hey, the right people can make a difference. He's a big people person, whether it be ticket takers, all the way to the front office, managers, players, everybody. He's a big, firm believer in the chemistry aspect of it on the human side. So in 1967, they struggle. He keeps Hank Bauer around because he had won a World Series. And in 1968, they struggle again, and he nominates a coach on the club that he had worked with in the minor leagues to become the manager, and that manager is number four, Earl Weaver. And Earl, as we all know, was an irascible sort of fiery individual. Harry Dalton was not that way. He was very calm. He never swore. He was very cordial. And so I asked Harry's wife Pat, who is still living, and I said, "Why Earl?" I said, "You can't get two different guys. Why Earl?" And she goes, "Earl was smart." She goes, "Earl had a drinking problem. Earl had a big mouth. But Earl was smart, and Harry liked smart." And so they could work together. And so they worked together through the minor league system, and even Brooks Robinson said the day that Harry Dalton was hired, we knew eventually Earl Weaver was going to be the manager in Baltimore. That was a foregone conclusion in the minds of all the players. So they're sort of simpatico, though, right? Because they're both information junkies. Bob Brown, the PR director for the Orioles for years, he did some of the first work for Harry and Earl on splits. Like, hey, who hits better against this guy? Because we're going to play him over player X and player Y. And it really becomes the foundation of a lot of the analytical stuff. You talk to GMs today, and they're like, "Well, that's the start of it, right?" I mean, it's taken off, and it's a growth industry. But like, the start of it is the stuff they were doing here. And Brownie was Harry's best friend. They cracked on each other. Their kids knew each other, and so that was the start of it. So the Orioles become the best team in baseball starting in 1969. They average 105 wins. And during this time, Harry Dalton sort of codifies what you would call the Oriole way. He actually has Don Priest, who was another scout for Harry, to actually write it down and go, okay, we're going to put out a manual. It's going to have all our plays in it, all our cutoffs, all our philosophies. It's going to have what we feel how players should conduct themselves and managers should conduct themselves on and off the field. And it's also going to, you know, sort of encapsulate how we do business. And that was the actual writing down of the Oriole way. I had an Oriole minor league player look at me once. He goes, "I never saw a manual." And I said, "Well, that's because the manual came along much later." He was in the early 60s, the manual came along much later, and he looks at me and goes, "I never knew that." I send him the manual, and I said, "Here it is." And he goes, "Wow, okay." So what it is it's a style of play, it's a way to handle people, it's a way to conduct yourself. That is the Oriole way. They win three straight pennants, 69, 70, and 71. They win the World Series in 1970. And it takes Roberto Clemente having just a fantastic year to you know, probably cost them another one. And 69, obviously, the Mets sort of caught fire and did what they did. And I often say that the Orioles are the other side of the miracle. You know, the people talk about the miracle Mets, and even though Mets fans don't see it as a miracle, and that's perfectly well and okay. Steve Getcher's like, "Yes, we don't. It wasn't. I got you." You know, he sees it as they were the best team in baseball, and it was the players, and it was the coaches, but it was also the guy that hired all of those people, and had worked there since 1954, and had seen a lot of bad baseball, and who supposedly got into a fight at Memorial Stadium with some Yankee fans who decided they were going to run their mouth a little bit, and Harry just decided that he wasn't going to have it. I have not been able to confirm that story twice, so but people that worked with him, you know, he loved this team. He loved this city. He had three daughters. They were all born right here. They're all Baltimoreans. He loved this city, he loved this town, and in fact, when he came back with Milwaukee and broke the hearts of Oriole fans by winning the 1982 American League East title, the morning of the game, the de facto 162nd, you know, playoff game that they played at Memorial Stadium, somebody asked him if he was nervous about the game because the Brewers had lost three in a row. And Harry looks at him and goes, "Are you kidding? This is my town. We're going to win." And I think people forget that Harry really was a linchpin of all the things that were going on here in Baltimore. So just a note on the images, this one I love is Don Buford and Earl and Harry in the tub. And I talked to Don Buford and he said, "We threw Harry in the tub because Harry was one of us. He was one of the boys. And he was having a good time. And me and Marcelino Lopez decided he needed to take a bath." So, I'll just go back through some of the pictures here. You know, Harry and Earl were just, they worked really hard with each other. And they worked really well together. There's the story that the Eastern League president calls Harry up when he's the farm director and goes, "You got to get control of Earl. All my umpires are going to quit. He has to calm down or we were going to throw him out. Like, he will be banned. You'll have to get somebody else." So Harry flies into his hometown of Springfield, Massachusetts on a plane and goes, takes Earl for a beer after the game. Says, "Earl, you will be a big league manager. You have to get out of your way. Like, you have to stop. Not stop. I love how you do things, but you have to understand that this is a bigger thing." And one of the things I think Harry was really good at in Baltimore and everywhere else was being able to show people, hey, what we're doing is towards a bigger end. So if we ask you to do something, or we're working with you, or even if it's a ticket taker going, "Hey, we're gonna do things a certain way," it was designed to show people that there was a bigger goal in mind. My other favorite, and I'll just take a minute here and tell it, my other favorite Harry story in Baltimore was, there is a gentleman who's a sheriff in North Carolina now. He grew up in Baltimore, and he was a kid in the late 60s, and he had taken his autograph collection to the players' entrance at Memorial Stadium to kind of get some pictures signed and everything, and he turned around at one point, and someone walked off with his pictures. Now, this is a 10-year-old kid, right? So, like, he is down. He is distraught. His mother is there. He's crying. And this guy drives by in a car and stops and gets out. And he asks, "Well, what's the problem, Jeff?" And he goes, "Well, you know, my autographs are gone. They're missing." And he goes, "Well, I'm Harry Dalton. And I'm the general manager, and I tell you what, I can't get your autographs back, but give me your address. Here's my card. Anything you need, you call me." And shortly thereafter, Jeff got not only glossies of his favorite players and autographs, but he got a team baseball signed with a letter from Harry Dalton saying, "Thank you for believing in us. Thank you for being a fan of our team. We're sorry what happened." But, you know, he was the kind of guy that genuinely would go the extra mile for everybody and teach everybody. I had a great conversation the other day with Dan Evans, and he said, "You know, I worked for Roland Heeman, and I didn't work for Harry, but Harry taught me. You learned how to do things." And I think that was the thing, and the linchpin of that was, there were a whole generation of Oriole players and even later executives. When Dan Duquette came back to Baltimore, the first thing he said is, "I work for Harry Dalton, and Harry Dalton's the father of the Oriole way, and we're going to get back to business here." And, you know, Dan had a very good run in Baltimore. So I got a few minutes left, but I just wanted everybody to know that's what I think about the Oriole way. When we sit and talk, Think about Harry Dalton, because he was a very important part of that, and he's a very important part of baseball history. And I'm looking forward to sharing his story with people. I have a book coming out in 2024 with Nebraska. It's going to be called Leave While the Party's Good, The Life, Times, and Legacy of Harry Dalton. And I appreciate you all coming in this morning to hear me talk about a person that I think is very important, not only to the history of the Orioles, but to the history of baseball as well. So thank you very much. All right, open the floor, I guess. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask, why did Harry Dalton leave at the 1971
goal?
Yeah, that's an interesting story and probably could be its own presentation. The short answer, the public answer, is that he felt he didn't have any more worlds to conquer. He had sort of done everything he could do here. The long answer is that he actually felt that he was underappreciated. He never wanted public affinity. He never wanted public applause for what he did, but he did want to be known in the team as someone that was willing to do the extra things. And Frank Cash and Jerry Hofberger weren't really forthcoming with that. And then they really started to be paternalistic. In fact, I've seen letters by Harry that at that time were very reminiscent of the things that Kurt Flood was arguing. Why am I working in a situation where I can't decide for myself if I want to better myself and go to another club? So in the end, he also felt that everyone should go west. At some point, everyone needed to stake their claim in the West. So he left, and he did it because he could get a 3-year contract and take care of his family, and he was tired of being underappreciated and everyone else saying, hey, it's this guy or it's this guy. But they weren't doing it publicly, they were doing it internally, and I think that was what was worse for him. Max.
Lee, well done.
Thank you.
Harry Dalton was in Baltimore for 6 years, and they were the best team in baseball for those 6 years.
Yep.
Harry Dalton was in Milwaukee, and for the first 6 years he was there, they were the best team in the American League.
Yep.
Why was he never able to do better in the 6 years in California than Tanana and Ryan and 3 days of Brian?
That's a very good question. So, I think what you have there is you have an institutional issue with the Angels that really derails some of the things that Harry Dalton tried to do. It takes time to build a farm system. Gene Autry was enamored by the Dodgers. He saw the Dodgers as their number one competitor, even though Harry Dalton came to California, and he looked at him and said, Gene, you realize they're in the other league, right? You know, like we have teams that we play every day, like, but the Dodgers were the pinnacle for him, and he believed in the Dodger way of doing things and thought that was the best way. And Harry said, I can give you that. I can give you a strong farm system that's going to win games. What Gene didn't know is that it takes a long time to do that. I mean, it really does. And, of course, you know, free agency came along and Harry made a big splash with Joe Rudy and Don Baylor and Bobby Grich. Baylor and Grich he had known from Baltimore. But there was always this, we need to pivot because we need to win now because LA's winning and we need to stay relevant. And it just, he wasn't given the time. When he went to work in Milwaukee, one of the things he told Bud Selig, and I have the notes from their initial meeting, one of the things that he had a list of maybe 25 things, and one of the things was, we're going to do this, we're going to do it how I think we're going to be able to sustain it. And so they were not only one of the best teams leading up to their World Series appearance in 82, but they were also one of the best teams after because they were able to keep that farm system stocked with players. They never won another pennant, but when you look at it, they were very, very productive right up until the time when Harry was replaced in Milwaukee. So, but as far as why they weren't There was just some institutional things that just never allowed Harry to really firmly plant the roots that he would in Milwaukee and California. Charlie.
Yeah, you were talking about Harry calling Baltimore his town.
Yeah.
But what about his relationship with the city of Milwaukee?
They loved Milwaukee. They all loved Milwaukee. They feel that Milwaukee was the place to go after California and allowed them to get back to the a semblance of normalcy. But that normalcy was because they had lived here. They saw Milwaukee as a lot of like this place personally. And I do talk about the Dalton family in my book a lot. It's a story. He's a family person, okay? He took care of his parents. He took care of Pat's parents. He was always there for his daughters. I have an interview with Harry Dalton, and he's being interviewed by Burke, who had written someone had written a book on the Union, and Harry was being interviewed, and he says, I have to take a phone call. And I played that for the girls, and they said, it was probably one of us wondering if we could go somewhere, you know? But he would always take those calls. He would go to their volleyball games. He would go to their recitals, all that stuff. So, but this was the linchpin of their relationship. He met his wife here. His wife went to Goucher College. Where this was home, and Milwaukee was a lot like that, but Milwaukee was never Baltimore. So, anybody else? In the back. You, sir, on the aisle.
Yeah, he tried to get Frank Robinson, I believe, for the 72 season from the Orioles, but he was ecstatic when he obtained him for the 73 season. Do you have anything on that?
He felt that Frank was the locker room presence that the Angels needed, the calming influence, right? They had come off gunfights and everything else in the locker rooms. And say what you will about Alex Johnson, but Alex Johnson had, now we know Alex had some mental health issues that didn't help his situation, and we would handle that situation much differently now than we did back in the 70s. But he felt that Frank would be good. The only thing was that Harry said, he thought Bobby Winkles was ready to be a big league manager. Bobby had been a coach in 72. He thought Bobby was ready to be a manager in 73. And the veterans in that clubhouse, Frank among them, just did not, the old college try was not flying in that locker room. And so Frank gave Harry 2 years and was like, nah, he was getting down to the end of his career. He wasn't as productive. But Frank Robinson and Harry Dalton would develop a relationship that lasted their entire lives, where Frank was a coach in Milwaukee. He was with the Angels. Frank and Harry, Frank could have fiery relationships with a lot of people, and Harry was not one of those guys. Harry and Frank got along really well, even though, Frank was sort of the instigator of some of the problems that Harry had with his early teams in California. So, Dan.
You nailed it. Great job.
Thank you.
He was an incredible man. The thing that I remember about Harry Dalton as a young baseball executive is how he came to me, introduced himself. I was working for one of his great friends, Roland Heeman, and said, let's you and I go out to lunch. I'd like to get to know more about you. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who's an icon for me.
Yep.
Went out to lunch with him, and it was like he was my new best friend.
Yep.
Throughout the rest of my career until he passed, he was always somebody I could call, and that's a special person with that level of success. He was never too big for anybody else in the room. And that's a really special man.
Yeah, I often say that Harry was, he never believed that he was Harry Dalton. He never believed that he was famous. He just was a guy that ended up doing something that he really loved. And you know what? That extends. I have been open arms with people like Dan and Dan Duquette and people that had played for Harry. And they've all said to me, Lee, you're trying to do something good for Harry, so we're going to help you out, because that's how he was. He'd be mad at us if we didn't help you. And that's Dan hit it right on the head. So thank you very much for the time this morning, and I appreciate it.